Now, all being well, we're going to have Brian Hughes on. Hello, Brian, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Oh, wonderful stuff. That's it. We've got the technology solved. This is new to me.
Yes,
anyway,
now,
it's very good to be talking with you today. Sadly, we're not actually seeing you. But Brian, of course, is our local guru and consultant solicitor at Shenfield-based Rayner Hughes. And he's going to be telling us a little bit about cohabitation. Is that right today?
Yeah, that's right, Scott. I can only tell you a bit because it's a very wide subject, but I'll do my best to compress the essentials into a short talk.
Right. So, anyway, so what exactly is the law as it pertains to cohabitation?
Well, cohabitation is a state that exists where a couple, opposite sex or same sex, live together with or without children. Cohabitants are defined in the Civil Partnerships and Certain Rights of Cohabitants Act 2010, a bit of a mouthful, I have to say.
Say that again.
As two same-sex or opposite-sex adults who are not married to each other, are not in a civil registered partnership, and are living in an intimate and committed relationship. As you'd expect, brothers and sisters and children living with parents are excluded from the definition of cohabitant.
So why is it even necessary to have a legal definition?
Well, it's important because so many couples live together these days without getting married or entering into a civil partnership, very much at their own peril. They live together in what appears to be the cozy glow of what they consider to be a permanent relationship and make assumptions about their rights and entitlements, which in the event of the death of one of them or the breakup of the relationship are totally and utterly false. As a result, they find themselves in all sorts of trouble.
So what sort of assumptions are you talking about here?
Well, the first and most dangerous assumption is that if a couple live together for a certain length of time, the survivor of them becomes entitled in some way to the assets of the person they've been living with. The concept of a common law marriage, where you live with someone for years, have children, share the costs of the home and of bringing up the children, and then inherit your cohabitant's property, is a complete myth. The truth is that if your cohabitant or cohabitees, I'll use cohabitant or cohabitee,
right. Okay.
You know, it's the same thing.
Yeah, sure.
If your cohabitee dies, the next of kin of your cohabitee will inherit his or her estate because you're not that person's next of kin.
Hmm.
The only way you'll inherit is if your cohabitee has made a will in your favour or your family home is registered at the land registry in joint names. The next of kin, for example, could be your children or your cohabitants' brothers, sisters or parents, and you could find yourself literally out in the cold. And the same difficult situation could arise in relation to your cohabitant's bank account unless you have the account in joint names.
So how can people cohabit protect themselves?
Apart from the traditional ways of putting the family home into joint names, having a joint bank account, and making wills in favour of each other, the only answer is entering into a cohabitation agreement, plus making wills in favour of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the main and most important thing for any cohabitant to understand is that without those things, he or she has no legal rights over the assets of the person he or she is living with on separation or death, except, and this is the only case, except where in the case of the family home, he or she has contributed to the purchase of the family home or to initial improvements made at the time of purchase. This is difficult to believe, but the cost of later improvements which a cohabitant has contributed cannot be recovered. Now, the children of cohabitees have rights to the assets of a parent, and this can also be a complicating factor.
So with so many uncertainties involved in couples living together without a marriage or civil partnership, why would anybody actually do it?
Well, Scott, that's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, but it must lie in the changing attitudes of society in which we live. Lots of couples, same sex and opposite sex, appear to decide to give a possible relationship a go, and if they're initially happy with it, settle into something that does not tie them down legally, and that appears to give them an easy opt-out if they don't eventually marry or enter into a civil partnership. Now, where in the case of an opposite sex relationship, a child or children come along, these couples tend to put a formal legal relationship on the back burner. It's a fact that the traditional opposite sex household of a married couple with children, husband, wife and children, is giving way to cohabiting opposite sex couples. Now, although married opposite sex couple families remain the most common, cohabiting opposite sex couples are the fastest growing family type. And following the introduction of the same-sex marriages, the number of same-sex couples has also doubled over the last 3 years and is increasing rapidly. Now, in my early days in the dim and distant past, as a solicitor, that's in the mid-1960s, marriage was the rule of the day, bestowing rights and obligations on the parties to it, which if either died or they divorced each other were clear-cut. They were determined by a court in accordance with statute or on divorce, or if there wasn't a will, in the case of death, by the intestacy rules. Unmarried couples unknowingly took an immense risk because they had no rights and no entitlements at all, and they still don't, unless they have jointly owned property, mutual wills, and a joint bank account, or have entered into a civil partnership, and this is where the cohabitation agreements are so useful.
Now, you've talked a lot about cohabitation agreements, so perhaps you could explain a little bit about what they actually cover.
Well, they're a sort of, they act as a sort of safety net for cohabitants, as well as being a very practical and sensible way of setting out who owns what, who's responsible for what, and what happens if the couple split up during their lifetime. A will is still necessary for the situation that arises on death, but the principal advantage of a cohabitation agreement is that it is a legally enforceable document, and in the case of a breakdown of a relationship, can be vital in establishing the entitlements of the cohabitants.
So, indeed, from what you said, any couple contemplating marriage would actually be well advised to consider the implications of living together as set out in this standard cohabitation agreement. Would that be right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, these cohabitation agreements are pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
And very practical. And as you say, many a couple contemplating marriage would be well advised to consider the implications of living together as set out in the standard cohabitation agreement, because it aims to define and regulate the rights and responsibilities of cohabitants while they're living together at the family home, and if they separate. The same rights and responsibilities apply to married couples and couples in civil partnerships. The agreement starts with the names, the dates of birth, and the status of each party. That's to say whether they're self-employed, employed, in training, full-time homemaker, or retired. And then it goes on to state the names and dates of birth of the children of each cohabitant, and whether they live at the family home or not, and children of the relationship are similarly named. The agreement then goes on to deal with the ownership of the family home, and will make clear whether the family home is already registered at the land registry, in whose name or names, and in what proportions, and what alterations to ownership will be made. It will state whether the property is leasehold or freehold, and whether the cohabitants are to be joint owners, survivor takes all that is, or 50-50 owners, or owners in different proportions. It then goes on to deal with household expenses, bank accounts, the proceeds of sale of the family home, and the status of other properties that are not the family home. It emphasizes that the agreement is to be binding on them and contains a declaration that each party has received independent legal advice on the content of the agreement and that they agree to be bound by it. So it's pretty comprehensive.
And you say it's very similar in reality to what you would get when you actually marry.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So I wonder how many people who, having read through such a document and considered all the ramifications, might not be frightened off the whole thing altogether.
Well, yeah, it's sort of pretty here. It lacks an element of romance, let's face it.
But, sure.
It's pretty useful, especially for lawyers.
All right. Well, look, let's leave it on that note. But I just wondered if you considered what you might look at in the future, assuming that we have a future. future.
In view of my age and the coronavirus outbreak, I'll have to isolate myself from the world in general for some time. So I suggest we wait a bit before fixing a date and a subject for my next appearance.
You and me both. Let's just hope all this panic and craziness goes away through soon. Thank you very much indeed, Brian.
Oh, that's a great pleasure, Scott.
All the best. Thank you.
See you then.
Bye. Yeah.